entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Oh, it is indeed. Hi there. Welcome in to a Sunday morning on the 19th day of May. It is the best of Downtown. Brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Rich Kimble here with Carrie Haskell. And it's our weekly look back at some fun recent conversations. Three good ones for you this morning, including Nick Parisi, who's written the definitive biography of Rod Serling. It's called Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. Also, Burley Drummond from the band Ambrosia. They've been together a long time. He's been there since the beginning. It looks back at some of their early days and the current makeup of the band that's still out there and touring. We get things underway this morning, though, by talking with a gentleman who has been everywhere in the last 50 years. Television, movies, the Broadway stage, touring companies, game shows. Filled in as the host of The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson some 80 times. And these days, lives in New Hampshire in the Lakes region and will be performing here in Maine tonight. Down at Johnson Hall in Gardner, we had a blast the other day talking with entertainer John Davidson.
Hi, Rich. Boy, you've got a wonderful show. I've been listening to a little bit of it, and congratulations on the show. And thanks for tuning into my concert window last night.
That was a blast. I had a great time watching that. That was your first one, and it was terrific.
Well, you're very nice. I had a lot of technical problems. I did about 12 minutes of songs and jokes and everything, and not realizing that no one could see me or hear me at the beginning of the show. And then my computer kept shutting off. You know, if you do a thing on a computer, you have to set it. I'm sure you know this because you're a smart guy, but I'm an old guy, and so my computer kept shutting off because you have to touch it. You have to poke it. Well, if you're playing guitar and singing and thinking about your show, you forget to poke the stupid computer. So it kept shutting off during the show, but it was still fun, and I appreciate you tuning in.
Well, you sounded great, and I was going to say you look great, but then you explained during the show last night that that's the third stage, people telling you, oh, you look great, so I'm not going to go there.
Yeah, there's three stages of life. There's youth, middle age, and you look good. It's pitiful, but we all make do. I'm going to be 78 in December.
It doesn't seem possible, and you don't look it at all, and you certainly don't sound like it. But I have to ask an important question here, because we're broadcasting in Bangor. Is it true that you had an Aunt Flossie right up the road in Charleston?
Yes. Oh, you knew her, too. I guess she got around. She must have worked the streets late at night, or I don't know what. No, I had a crazy old Aunt Flossie, a really eccentric lady, who lived in Charleston, and we used to go up there summers. Matter of fact, I lived in West Bridgewater, Mass. At the time, this was in the 50s, and one summer I bought my horse. My dad put the horse in a trailer and hauled it up there behind the car, and I spent the summer, two different summers, with my horse in Charleston, and I don't remember ever going into Bangor, but we would hear about got to go to Bangor. That's where everything is happening. But one of my relatives started the Higgins Institute, what it was called, in Charleston. And so I had some family there. And that's beautiful country up there.
And you were a New Englander once again, living in New Hampshire these days.
Yeah, we live in the Lakes region near Meredith, New Hampshire. My daughter and her husband and my sixth grandchild live in Salem, Mass. And so we literally took a map, and my wife of 35 years, Rhonda, did a string around Salem out into the ocean, but we didn't care about that. But a string to try to find something within 2 hours of Salem. And we found this. It's 23 acres. It's an old farmhouse that somebody from New York has redone and put a lot of money into. but we didn't pay a lot of money for the. I think they couldn't sell it because it's not near water. We live near water, and I didn't care about that. We live in the woods, and we just love it. It's a great old house, and it's we had family Christmas there this last Christmas, and that's New Hampshire is so great, especially in the fall, as Maine is too. You know, the fall and the fireplace and that whole thing is so great. By the way, we love Maine in another way. We go up to a place called Gray Havens Inn. We must have been there maybe 8 or 9 times over the years, ever since the early 90s. It's on 5 islands. It's near Georgetown, above Bath. And we've had such great getaways up there. We just love Maine. And my dad used to go to Old Orchard Beach. My dad was a preacher. I'm not religious at all, but my dad was a Baptist minister and used to go up to this place called Old Orchard Beach, I think it was.
Yes.
There in Maine. Have you ever heard of that?
I have, yeah. Mostly populated by middle-aged Canadian men wearing thongs.
I don't want to see that.
No.
For the bathing suit.
You're in concert this Sunday night, 6 p.m. at beautiful Johnson Hall in Gardner. And is it going to be similar to what we saw last night in the concert window performance? Is it you and your guitar?
Oh, yeah. But the difference is that I'm totally mobile. I move all over the stage and in and out of the audience. And it's a very physical show. So to set me down on a stool and do almost like a radio show with my concert. That was very strange to me. So, yeah, I move around a lot, and I treat each song as if I'm storytelling, and I do a very physical show. So, yeah, it's going to be different for that. The Johnson Hall, you know, they're raising money to redo this fabulous theater on the upper floor, but I'm performing, I think, in the lower space, right?
I believe so, but both are beautiful. It's a great venue.
Yeah, and the people are so nice there. I went to see Jonathan Edwards.
Yes,
Edwards there, and the artistic director came up and said to me, he came up and said, "You're John Denver, aren't you?" I said, "No, John Davidson." He said, "Oh, that's right." No, I'm just kidding. And he said, "What are you doing now?" And I said, "I do a show with my guitar, a little bit like Jonathan Edwards, and I would love to play your place." And he said, "We would love to have you." So we made this deal about a year ago, and now I'm looking forward to it.
It's going to be great. Also, next week, I believe, you'll be appearing on Gilbert Gottfried's podcast.
This crazy guy. Oh, my goodness. I never met a guy who uses the F word as much as he does, and it's great. I mean, he does just a crazy podcast, and he's out there. He has such a sweet guy. It's a little bit like I don't know, what is he like? Gilbert Gottfried, I think, is one of a kind. But he and his wife are so nice, and I love this guy.
You're also mentioning last night that you're working on a pilot for, I believe it's WMUR in New Hampshire, for a show called What's Next.
Yeah, Rich, thanks for bringing that up. I'm at the age where a lot of my friends are reinventing themselves and trying to figure out what's next, you know? When you get up, when you pass 60, you got to figure out, do you want to sit and watch TV all day or drink wine all day? Or do you want to sit in a chair and watch the sunset? Or do you want to just have some project and make something of this home stretch of life. It's a little depressing to call it the home stretch because then you're thinking of the finish line. But let's call it What's Next in the what do you really love to do? That's the question. This show, it's a half-hour weekly show, if I can sell it to the station there in Manchester, New Hampshire. It's just a local station. But what do you really love to do in your life? You got to sit down and make a list. And I did that a couple of years back. And what I really love to do is to sing with my guitar. So over these years, you know, I've played Las Vegas. I played the Elvis Showroom with an 18-piece orchestra with strings. I sang with Doc Severinsen's band on The Tonight Show, and I did a lot of variety with huge orchestras, and I sang with symphony orchestras. But my favorite part was when I got out my guitar and the freedom of singing with myself and telling stories through song and writing songs with my guitar is what I love to do. So I'm an American troubadour now and loving this, and I do it in big theaters or small spaces or whatever. It's a little bit like Garth Brooks. I've seen Garth Brooks perform with just his guitar, and it's incredible freedom that you can do. So, yeah, that's what I've kind of reinvented myself as that, and it really works. Well, it works for me.
Well, we know what a terrific singer you are, and you've been for so many years. The storytelling, too, comes naturally, and I mean this as a great compliment, John. Nobody was better at weaving a lie than you were on Hollywood Squares.
That's right. Yeah, when I was guesting on Hollywood Squares, sitting next to Karen Ballantyne with Paul Lynde in the center square, and Wally Cox and George Gobel and Charlie Weaver and that whole gang, Rosemary, I made up fake answers. Because they give you a joke to say, and I wasn't good at just one-line jokes. So I became an expert on absolutely nothing, a little bit like Professor Irwin Corey. But then I got a chance to host the show. I was the second host from 86 to 92. And that was great. My center square was Joan Rivers and Shadow Stevens and, of course, Jim J. Bullock and Alf and a bunch of other crazy regulars. But Hollywood Squares is a kind of a proven point. If you set up nine celebrities, you gotta like somebody, right? And if you give them a joke or two, it can be entertaining. And so I was pretty proud of that. I was doing that after I had hosted That's Incredible. Mm. So That's Incredible had been canceled. I was trying to figure out what to do. And being a game show host wasn't my idea of success. I wanted to do, my live show or do an action series or something. But this came along, and it was a great chance. It was a lot of fun. I got a chance to meet a lot of famous people.
We're talking with John Davidson on Downtown. He'll be at Johnson Hall in Gardner on Sunday night. You also have transformed into an old liberal, and you're proud of that label. How much of a transformation was that for you?
Well, over the years, both my parents were ordained Baptist preachers, and I came from a very conservative family. But I don't know. You go to college. I took a course in logic and comparative religions of the world, and kind of I really got to see the big picture about what religion really is and how man-made it is in my mind. So I just made the decision to go towards science and logic as opposed to voodoo or the leap of faith that religion takes. And then I began meeting theater people as a theater arts major. And theater people in general are a more liberal, progressive group. And I like these people. I like their commitment to humanity and to making life better. So I like what progressives are doing to make the world better instead of holding on to the past, sort of. So every year I get a little bit more liberal and crazy. I like it that way. Somehow, the older I get, the less I know for sure. I think some people become more conservative as they get older. I've gotten more Doubting Thomas, if you go back to the Bible, just more skeptical and more of a cynic and more trying to get to figure out what is real. I can't, especially with this president, it's hard to figure out what is real. So I guess that's what I'm into, is trying to figure out how to be more honest about things and figure out what is real. And that's taken me towards a liberal slant.
Well, we can't wait for Sunday night, Johnson Hall and Gardner. You are the consummate entertainer. Anybody who can do what you did last night on that little screen, as you said, stuck on a stool and make that absolutely captivating for an hour, we know it's going to be amazing when you're up and moving around and telling great stories and singing terrific songs with your guitar Sunday night. John, it's such a treat for us to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Rich, you've made me feel like a big guy. You made me feel important. Thank you.
That is John Davidson tonight down at Johnson Hall in Gardner. The show gets underway at 6, and last I checked, tickets still available. You can go online to their website for more information. When we come back, Rod Serling, of course, best known for his creation that turned 60 this fall, The Twilight Zone, but much more to him than that. Author Nick Parisi tells us all about it after this on The Best of Downtown.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Spring is here, and that means biking season. And the experts at Slipping Gears have just what you need. They're the area's premier full-service bike shop, located at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. With outstanding service and a huge stock, they've got the parts, accessories, and the expert advice you need, as well as the fastest repairs around and a great selection of new bikes. Open Monday through Friday, 9 to 6, Saturdays, 9 to 5, and you can shop online anytime at slippinggears.com. Slipping Gears, 753 Stillwater Avenue, Bangor.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Pretty sure this should be considered a public service announcement. So in advance, you're welcome. I just went to the Ground Round in Bangor and had the most amazing food from their special menu. First, I got the Reuben Egg Rolls, which is all the flavors of the classic Reuben sandwich wrapped in a crispy egg roll and served with savory garlic smoky paprika sauce that has this slight kick. It's so good. To go with it, I ordered the Memphis fries, French fries loaded with pulled pork, drizzled with barbecue sauce, topped with chopped pickles and diced onions. If your mouth is watering right now, head to the Ground Round on Audlin Road in Bangor. GroundRound.com.
Success. For some, it's the result of luck. For the Maine Black Bears, it's the result of planning, determination, and hard work. Success may have brought you financial rewards, and now in many ways, life isn't simpler, it's more complex. Your choices impact more people and can have longer lasting effects than ever before. At ClearPoint Financial, we understand your challenges. We can help navigate today's changing financial landscape and help you pursue your financial goals. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. See what ClearPoint Financial can do for you. Call us today at 307-7718.
We're back on The Best of Downtown on your Sunday morning. Rich Kimball. Then Kerry Haskell. And some gold in earring.
It's 2 a.m. Figure it out. It's 2 a.m. The sun's still warm.
This fall celebrates the 60th anniversary of The Twilight Zone, one of the most iconic shows in television history. But author Nick Parisi has dug deep to learn there's much more about Rod Serling than that, as he was able to find early teleplays from his live television work in the 1950s, and also goes in depth on his work post-Twilight Zone in his new book, Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. Congratulations, and thank you as a Rod Serling fan for this incredible book and the research, which I can't imagine how long it took, but worth all that time, because it's the most comprehensive look at Rod Serling that I've ever seen.
I appreciate that, Rich. Thanks. Thank you very much. I approached it right from the very beginning as I intended it to be the most complete assessment of Rod Serling's work of his entire career from beginning to end. And it's nice to hear at least one person that thinks that I succeeded in what I just set out to do.
Well, and of course, all of us seemingly started with The Twilight Zone, although some folks may have started with Night Gallery. But it's, to me, so fascinating to learn about what happened before and after Twilight Zone. And that's, to me, what makes this book so fascinating. And I want to go back, well, almost to the beginning, not all the way back to Binghamton, but back to Cincinnati. Can you talk a little bit about the role that Cincinnati, the Storm, and that time in his life played in the development of Rod Serling as a writer?
Sure. It was instrumental. It was, that was the period that Rod Serling was really cutting his teeth as a dramatic writer. He was learning his craft, learning to write at that time. And he really got lucky in a lot of ways, because when he got out of college in Ohio, he first got a job at WLW Radio, which was a very depressing job for him. It was, just writing fluff pieces and, news patter and things like this. And he was not happy with that. But when he got a chance to write for this series called Storm on WKRC-TV, the nice thing about it was a couple of things, really. Was, first of all, they didn't have a sponsor at the time. It was a self-sustaining show, meaning WKRC was paying the freight for the show. And because they didn't have a sponsor, Rod Serling did not have anybody really to butt heads with as far as subject matter went and theme went. So he really had a lot of freedom to address some of those topics that he would later get into trouble with on network television. So he didn't have that problem on The Storm. And then the other thing was that the producer of The Storm, a man by the name of Bob Huber, really did give him a lot of leeway and a lot of freedom to write what he wanted to write. So he wrote a lot of science fiction and a lot of fantasy, as well as drama. And he was able to do what he did later in his career, which is try to use television as a vehicle to address, socially relevant themes. And he did it very well. And, when you read those old scripts, that it's the early, it's a writer in his developing stage. But it's pretty remarkable when you really look at it, what he was able to get accomplished at that time.
And it's amazing to think that you had a local television station back in those early days doing these full-scale live productions.
Yeah, it was as far as I can tell, it was the first and only show at that time to do a weekly live dramatic original program like this. And it was broadcast only in that Cincinnati area. It wasn't fed to the networks or anything. And, the bad news about that, of course, is that almost none of these shows still exist. Almost none of them were actually filmed or kinescoped at the time. So it's pretty much a lost part of Rod Serling's career, unfortunately.
Well, and to me, that's what makes your research so important, because so many of these shows, not just the ones done in Cincinnati, but many that were broadcast on network television, are gone forever. But can you talk a little bit about how you were able to track down these scripts from those early years, whether it was from the Cincinnati days or from things like the Hallmark Hall of Fame, the Kraft Television Theater, and others?
Yeah, well, the one thing I had in my, to my advantage was that Rod Serling, he left behind this enormous paper trail. He was the type of person who kept everything. So he actually set up archives. He donated most of his materials to the Wisconsin State Historical Society in Madison, Wisconsin, and that's a whole story in itself why it's there. But he donated 80 boxes of materials to that location. There are scripts, and there's correspondence and contracts, letters, all sorts of things are there. So that's like the treasure trove. So my first stop was there, just to go through absolutely everything there. But there are other archives. There's one at UCLA when he was teaching, he was living not far from UCLA. He donated a lot of stuff there. And then at Ithaca College, when he was teaching there, he donated some things there. So there are essentially three different archives that I had to go to track down these scripts. And then beyond the scripts, then I also just watched absolutely everything that still exists, and there's a lot of it. The Paley Center in New York City has a real nice catalog of old television, including Serling, of course, so I was able to watch everything that they have, and I was able to collect a lot of things on my own. So if something exists, I watched it, and in the book, if I have a synopsis of something, it's based on me watching it or reading the actual script.
And not everything in those early years was a masterwork, and you're very honest in your assessment of some of those, but also a number of the early stories and even the local productions would eventually find their way in some fashion, many of them into the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, Serling was, he was a master at recycling. Recycling, not just from a practical standpoint, like, you know, I can use a story idea and you'll get paid for it again, but he had certain themes and certain, you know, certain character types that he wanted to reexamine over and over again. So he would do that. He would take a theme from an earlier story that maybe hardly anybody saw on some live television show early on, and he would reuse it in, you know, in a new series and with a new character, whatever it may be. So yeah, some of the stuff from The Storm found its way into the Twilight Zone. Some of the stuff, you know, a lot of things from his early career ended up being recycled into all different series that he did later on.
We're talking with Nick Parisi here on Downtown. In 1954, Rod Serling and his wife Carol left and moved east to be closer to New York, moved to Connecticut, and in early 1955 had what was really his first national success of the show that put him on the map, and that was the production of Patterns. And as you pointed out, it made him a star. It gave him great confidence and it gave him some freedom, but also it was really the start of him battling with censors for the next several years.
Yeah, because he really did have, he had a name all of a sudden. All of a sudden he had some stature. And he said, if I have this stature, I am going to use it. I'm going to use it for what I think is important. And that is not only to address socially relevant subjects on television, but also to write, you know, to try and uplift television, to try and expand it into becoming an actual art form, to try and, you know, make it progress as far as, you know, the themes that it addressed, and also in the, you know, the language, really, the writing level, the level of the writing. And he wanted to do that. So, but especially with the themes that he wanted to address, particularly prejudice, he was up against the sponsors and the network censors every time he tried to do it. But he did try. He continued to try, even though, you know, as I put it in the book, he would lose these battles, but he would always go down fighting. And that was the important thing.
Well, Patterns made him a star, but it would be a while before he could, in some ways, seem like get the albatross of Patterns off from around his neck. And it would take the success of Requiem for a Heavyweight to do that.
Yeah, you know, the one thing I try to get across in the book, though, is that I think that for Serling, you know, Serling always played up that idea that it took so long for Requiem to finally break through and, you know, take that Patterns, you know, as you said, albatross off of his neck. But the period between Patterns and Requiem for Heavyweight, I think Rod Serling wrote plenty of really good things in there. They just weren't quite of the critical success that Patterns was. I mean, he wrote The Rack in between Patterns and Requiem for Heavyweight, and The Rack was one of Serling's favorite pieces of work, and I happen to think it's one of his best scripts. He wrote some other things that were very, very good in that period, but for Serling, he really needed the critical success that Patterns had given him, and then Requiem surpassed Patterns. If anything, it was a gigantic success.
Another success in an acclaimed script was The Velvet Alley. And as you explain in the book, that might be as close to the real Rod Serling as we get in that story.
It's one of them, yeah. I mean, Rod Serling was autobiographical in several of his pieces of work. But The Velvet Alley is one where he really took an actual incident, which was him essentially breaking up with his agent at the time. And he extrapolated on it. He said, what if, you know, this is how it went bad? You know, if a writer did that and really kind of sold himself out to the success, you know, this is what could happen. So he kind of saw what was happening to himself and brought it to the extreme. And he would say, it wasn't my story, but it could have been my story, or it could have been anybody's story.
And actually, the real story of what happened when he left for another agent tells us a lot about the real Rod Serling and the care he took to make sure that she was protected.
Yeah, he really did. He made sure that that his prior agent was taken care of in the new contract, that she would still continue to get a piece of scripts that the new agents sold on his behalf, and that she would basically still continue to handle his television work in New York, and that they would concentrate on his feature film work in Hollywood. So she really did take every possible measure to keep her under consideration.
we moved to the Twilight Zone, and what preceded that was a special entitled The Time Element that many people refer to as the pilot for the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, we say it's, you know, the unofficial pilot, you know, because it was, you know, wasn't the Twilight Zone, but it was supposed to be. It was Rod Serling submitted it to CBS as the Twilight Zone, the Time Element, and it was supposed to be the pilot for the Twilight Zone. And what happened was the network people read it and they rejected it as a pilot. And they rejected it because they just felt that the ending, or really the premise in general, but the ending particularly, was going to be too outlandish for the general, you know, public to grasp. And looking at it now, you think they must have thought we're all idiots, because it's not that difficult a concept to grasp. It's a time travel issue, and it's just, you know, it's a typically ambiguous Twilight Zone-esque ending, but it's really not that outlandish. But at the time, it was. So they rejected it, and the Desilu Playhouse bought it, and because Desi Arnaz and the producer at the time, they both loved Serling and they loved this particular script, and they wanted it. So they produced it on the Desilu Playhouse, and it was a big hit. It got a lot of positive viewer mail, and, you know, got, you know, good notices in the papers, and it kind of opened up CBS's eyes to the idea that, you know, maybe the public is ready for this type of show. And the Twilight Zone had already been, you know, he'd already been negotiating it, and this just kind of pushed it over the hump.
And then in the fall of 1959, The Twilight Zone would premiere on CBS. We're actually going to be talking with Earl Holloman in a couple of weeks, who starred in that first episode, Where Is Everybody? And right from the get-go, that episode separated Twilight Zone from everything else that was on TV at the time.
It really, really did. It was, you know, in a lot of ways, it's really the perfect pilot, because it really showcased what The Twilight Zone was about. It didn't, but it didn't do it in a really outlandish way. It was accessible to the average person. They were able to grasp what was going on in the show, even if the character himself is confused. And the whole show is about this guy who wakes up in a town and doesn't know who he is, and there's nobody else in the town. He doesn't know where he is, and he's just trying to find out what's going on. You know, so it's a one person show. And it makes the audience really, you know, identify with that single character, and it's easily graspable. And the ending is, you know, a Twilight Zone type of, you know, twist ending. So it did the job of the pilot. It sold the show, and it got very good reviews, and the show was off and running from there.
Five seasons of The Twilight Zone before it wrapped up, and you have to wonder, looking back, because he did die at such an early age, the demands of doing that show, because he wrote an incredible number of the scripts that were aired on The Twilight Zone. Could anybody have kept that up for more than 5 years?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that anybody could have, and he certainly would have admitted that he was running out of gas at the end of The Twilight Zone. I mean, he wrote 92 of the Twilight Zone's 156 episodes, and that's just a phenomenal number. And by the end, yes, the quality of the Twilight Zone scripts were certainly slipping in that fifth season. So, you know, it probably was a good idea that it did end. But, you know, I think I make the point in the book that I think, you know, as much as Rod Serling said that he was burned out and tired and fatigued at the end of the fifth season, he would have continued the Twilight Zone if somebody had offered him a sixth season. I think he would have done it forever if he could have. And he would have probably just, you know, unfortunately written himself, you know, into the grave, you know, because he was just that type of guy. He was a workaholic, and he just wrote, and he was just incredibly prolific and incredibly productive. That was just his way.
Well, and it almost happened. One of the big surprises I learned from the book was the story of Odd Street. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was, you know, that was a really nice, for me as a fan, a nice discovery that I found, because I'd heard this title, Odd Street, before, kind of vaguely, but I didn't know what it was. But it turned out that, yeah, Rod Serling had this idea for a Twilight Zone-esque kind of show after the Twilight Zone called Odd Street. And all I could find was his idea for, well, two things, really. One was the idea for the intro, which was a Twilight Zone type of intro where the narrator, you know, assuming it's Serling, is walking down a, you know, looks like a normal nighttime city street, and he's talking about all the weird things that are on the street, and you see that, you know, there's a calendar in the window that says it's February 31st, you know, and then the camera spins, and you'll see the eye in an optometrist's window. It's a cardboard eye, but then the lid closes. Or, you know, then there's a florist with a Venus flytrap, and it opens up, and there's a hand inside, you know. And so all these strange imagery is going on. And he says, you know, you got to be careful what you buy here. This is Odd Street. And then, you know, the script that he actually submitted with that title was called The Doomsday Flight. Well, The Doomsday Flight, you know, the script was rejected as a pilot, but The Doomsday Flight ended up being produced as a made-for-TV movie later on. So it was a very interesting little discovery I was able to make in my research.
Nick Parisi with us here on Downtown. His book is Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. How appropriate that it was 58 years ago today that Newton Minow gave his very famous speech referring to much of television as a vast wasteland, and yet he singled out Rod Serling in The Twilight Zone. I find myself watching episodes even now that are 60-some years or 50-some years old and thinking, how did he get away with this? But Rod Serling knew that science fiction was a way to get some serious points out there, and he did that perhaps better than anybody else has done in the history of the medium.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. And you know, not only did he do it better, but he did it first. You know, so he paved the way. He paved the way for every science fiction and fantasy series that came afterward. And he, you know, he set the standard. He really raised the bar by refusing to dumb down the series, by refusing to make it any less intelligent than it was. He raised that bar for every science fiction show that came afterward. And it really is amazing that we're talking about this is, you know, it's the 60th anniversary of The Twilight Zone. And what, you know, what other black and white television series are we talking about like this? It's just, there aren't any. There really aren't any. You know, it's amazing that these shows are still relevant, that people are still interested in them. And Rod Serling would be amazed. He really would. He'd be amazed that we're still talking about this.
Well, we were just talking about that the other day, and the fact that people will still watch shows from the 60s, and whether it's I Love Lucy, The Honeymooners, or any of those, you watch them, but always with that heavy sense of nostalgia. And to me, there's none of that in The Twilight Zone because they remain as relevant as ever.
It's timeless. Yeah, it is timeless. And you know, I love those other shows you mentioned too, but I'm not sure that any of those shows are really on marathons on New Year's Eve and 4th of July. You know, I mean, there was a magazine that came out just a couple months ago. It was a British magazine that had was listing the 100 greatest television series of all time. And on the cover, and this wasn't just science fiction, on the cover it had Mad Men and Seinfeld and Game of Thrones and Twilight Zone. You know, Twilight Zone was the only black and white show on the cover of this magazine. You know, my local paper, Long Island's Newsday, did a Twilight Zone feature, a whole section on the Twilight Zone just a few months ago. And this wasn't the new Twilight Zone, this was the original Twilight Zone. I mean, no other 60-year-old TV series is viewed in that way. It's really, really amazing.
Everybody's got a favorite episode of The Twilight Zone. Nick, what's yours?
If I really had to pick one, I think I would have to go with Walking Distance.
Mine as well.
That is, you know, Rod Serling's kind of archetypal, you know, meditation on his desire to return to Binghamton, to return to his childhood, his innocent time before the war, and just to go back and, you know, get on a merry-go-round and eat cotton candy and all that. I mean, the older I get, the more I love that episode. But I got to say, I've always loved that episode. Even when I was a kid, I loved that episode. So it's always been near the top, but I think it's taken over the top spot for me at this point.
Now, just as Rod Serling's pre-Twilight Zone career was pretty lengthy and productive, he did a lot after the series as well, from The Loner to Planet of the Apes, Night Gallery, The Man. Not all of them were successes. From your perspective, what was his most significant and lasting post-Twilight Zone work?
Oh, that's a really good question, because his post-Twilight Zone work, that is one of the real things that pushed me to write this book, because I felt like the post-Twilight Zone career has been really, really mischaracterized. I mean, if you read most of what's been written previously, it's that you get the idea that there was the Twilight Zone, and then Rod Serling just kind of fell off the cliff after that, and, you know, he didn't write anything good after the Twilight Zone. But in the book, I hope I get across that he wrote some great things after the Twilight Zone. I mean, if we're just talking quality, I think the best thing that he wrote was actually an episode of the Chrysler Theater called A Slow Fade to Black.
Yes.
With Rod Steiger. Mm. And this is one of the great unknown stories of Rod Serling's career. It's one of the best things he ever wrote, and hardly anybody has ever seen it. You know, it's just it's about a movie mogul who is dealing with losing control of his empire, basically. And it's a powerful, powerful story. I mean, that's a great one. And I, you know, talk about in the book, I love The Loner. I love the Western series he did right after the Twilight Zone. I think it's, you know, just a brilliant, brilliant show.
In the book, you talk about a legacy as timeless as infinity and eternity, and my goodness, the names, and you mentioned some of them earlier. When you talk about Rod Serling's legacy, you talk about the people who are making shows in this new golden age of television, and they seemingly all mention Rod Serling as inspiration.
Yeah, and you know, one noteworthy thing about that is we're generally talking about writers and showrunners who are writing straight drama. They're not writing science fiction. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Mad Men and Sopranos and, you know, and Breaking Bad and The Wire and things like this. These are the guys who really, really worship Rod Serling. They again see him as the forerunner for what they're doing. He was the guy who broke down those doors and made television, you know, something more than it was at the time. And really just seeing what he did. I mean, when he was on The Twilight Zone, Rod Serling worked 16-hour days. I mean, he did everything on the show from beginning to end, you know. So a lot of these guys now who have real control over their series, they see Rod Serling as being the first to do that.
Well, this is a wonderful work. Again, a comprehensive history and analysis of the work of Rod Serling. Rod Serling, his life, work, and imagination. Nick, it's been great talking with you. I hope we can do it again as we continue to celebrate the 60th anniversary of Twilight Zone.
I hope so, Rich. Thank you very much.
Author Nick Parisi here on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. When we come back, we'll take you back to the 70s and early 80s. Burley Drummond from the hit-making band Ambrosia, next on Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since 2005, Pineland Farms Dairy has been making the finest cheese in Maine. Our cheddar, Monterey Jack, Pepper Jack, Baby Swiss, feta, and cheese curds are all made with natural milk from Maine. Find Pineland Farms cheese at Hannaford supermarkets, Shaw's, Whole Foods, and other great shops throughout Maine and New England. Visit online at pinelandfarmsdairy.com. Maine cows, Maine milk, Maine cheese, Pineland Farms.
Don't feel like making dinner tonight? Don't worry, Angelo's Pizzeria has got you covered. With locations in Bangor and Hamden, Angelo's is never too far from where you are. Pizza made from the finest ingredients and fresh dough, sandwiches, and subs. Calzones, pasta, chicken, burgers, salads, and more. You can find something for everyone in the family at Angelo's. Give them a call at 942-5553 or stop in at 499 Hammond Street in Bangor or 102 Main Road South in Hamden. That's Angelo's Pizzeria, open daily from 11 a.m. until 10 p.m.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor.
Penobscot Theater Company presents Sequins, Spandex, and the Music of ABBA. The sunny and funny, enchanting tale of love, laughter, and friendship. Mamma Mia! At Bangor's Historic Opera House, June 13th through July 14th. Tickets at 942-3333 and penobscottheater.org. Walk in, dance out!
We're back on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning. Rich Kimball, Carrie Haskell here with you. Our next guest on the program is a founding member of the California-based band Ambrosia. Had a ton of hits through the years, starting with their very first single, which in 1975 made the top 20. Interestingly enough, lyrics taken from Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle. Here's Nice, Nice. Very Nice, from Ambrosia.
Oh, a sleeping trumpet up in Central Park, or the lion hunter in the jungle dark.
Burley Drummond shared with us the story of how that song came to be and talked about the genesis and the transformation of Ambrosia when he joined us recently here on Downtown. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thank you, man. Pleasure to be here. And you forgot to mention that I was an erotic dancer, too. But I appreciate it.
I saw that. You know, I didn't know if you wanted to go there or not.
No, I gave it up a long time ago.
I want to go back to the beginning, if we can. You guys have been together for such a long time. You were formed in San Pedro, and that is a very diverse area. Did that have a big influence on your early sound?
Well, I think it did. I think, San Pedro was kind of a melting pot. It was a port town. It's the port of, Long Beach. San Pedro is the port of Los Angeles. So you had all ethnic races there. And so you heard and encountered people from all over the world. And it, kind of opened us up to music from all over the world. And I think it really influenced our writing. So, yeah.
And you were already studying that kind of thing in college, studying ethnomusicology, and all of you sort of had your own musical preferences coming in.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, everybody had, it was four, fairly diverse people in style and like, even though we shared common things like the Beatles, of course, and certain, the Rolling Stones, but, I was the ethnic guy and the jazz guy, and Chris North was kind of a blues guy, and Dave and Joe both had, Dave was very pop, Beach Boys, and Joe was very singer-songwriter, like Jackson Brown, So we have, like, four different things coming together.
So you're making your first album. How does a brand-new band get Alan Parsons to come mix the album?
Well, we were very lucky in that sense because we had just finished the album and he was coming to town for the Grammys I think he won a Grammy that year for Dark Side of the Moon. And so we arranged to have him come by and hear our material and hear what we were doing. And when he heard it, he said, yes, he'd be delighted to mix it. And that gave us a lot of credit, that Alan Parsons would consider mixing us. And so we realized we must be on something good.
That first album was so tremendous, and it caught my attention because as a young guy, my favorite writer was Kurt Vonnegut, and you had me at the beginning with the first cut. Nice, nice, very nice. How did that happen that you took a little bit of Cat's Cradle and turned it into such a terrific song?
Right. That's the song of Volcanon from Cat's Cradle. And I tell you, in our naivete, we wrote the song. Joe Puerta of Ambrosia came in one day with these lyrics that we were writing. We had a song in progress called, and the sonnet that he brought in was called Nice, Nice, Very Nice. And we had some other title for it. And the lyrics of that song of Volcanon fit perfectly in Nice, Nice, Very Nice. So, Joe co-wrote a second verse to go with it. And we finished the album. We finished the mixing and everything. And then one day toward the end of mixing, somebody asked us, hey, did anybody ask Kurt Vonnegut if you could use his lyrics? we all panicked, like, no! So we contacted his lawyer and sent a recording to him. And luckily, he accepted graciously and said he was delighted and honored to be a part of our music, so... It worked out beautifully.
And you guys ended up meeting him a little bit later, is that right?
Yeah, we did. And that was a whole interesting experience because we went to his townhome in New York, and we were led upstairs to his writing room. And when he answered the door, of the room to let us in, he was so deep in a character that he was writing that it took him a few minutes to become Kurt Vonnegut again. I mean, it was like an amazing transformation before your eyes, and it made me really respect how deep an artist can go and what they're doing.
You also worked with Leonard Bernstein on that first album, and you ended up getting pretty close to the Bernstein family, right?
And very close. I used to date his daughter for a minute, and Jamie, and they were wonderful people. I mean, of course, you know, Bernstein, whether he agreed with you or not, it was always exciting, and just the discussions alone with him will last a lifetime. So it was a wonderful experience.
We're talking with Burley Drummond of Ambrosia. You guys were nominated for Grammys for the first album and then followed it up with Somewhere I've Never Traveled. And that was very different. How did you approach it differently than you did the first album?
Well, I think we were kind of, once we were solidified kind of in our kind of art, progressive music vein, when we did our first album, we did like 60 demos of everything from country music to pop music to the prog, you know, progressive side. And the president of the company, Russ Regan, came in, and he's the one that discovered Neil Diamond and Barry White and Olivia Newton-John and Elton John. So, you know, he had some good set of ears. He came in and he picked like three songs. It was Nice Nice, Holding On, and Mama Frog, I believe. And he goes, this is the direction I want. He goes, all this other stuff is very good. He goes, I don't have this. You know, I have pop music, but I don't have this kind of music. Can you give me an album like this? So we felt, you know, we finished the first album, and then the second album was kind of a continuation of that. And then we got, you know, influenced by adding orchestra to a big piece called Cowboy Star. And, you know, the second album wasn't as commercially popular because we didn't have the hit on it like Holding On to Yesterday. And so that was kind of, after that, we moved on and went to Warner Brothers and started having a few hits, you know?
So. Sure did. We played the title track of your third album that you co-wrote, Life Beyond L.A. I love that song. My favorite song on that album, and I always thought it could have been a huge hit if it was released as a single, was If Heaven Could Find Me.
Wow. Well, that's a great honor that you said that, because I wrote that one. You know, I mean, the music business is very fickle. You know, you usually get one shot or two out of the gate, and How Much I Feel obviously was a no-brainer that was going to be a single. And I don't know what we released after that. Might have been Can't Let a Woman or something like that. I'm not sure. No, Can't Let a Woman was on the second album, I believe. I forget what we released after that. But, you know, once you release a single that doesn't happen, it's hard to come back with another one.
Sure, and once you release How Much I Feel and it becomes a mega hit, all of a sudden you guys have been a progressive band. Now you're an R&B band.
Well, that was interesting, too, because, you know, we kind of grew up with the theory that, you know, we were kind of modeling ourselves after the Beatles somewhat in the sense that, you know, they could write anything. And, you know, they could write a song like Yesterday and then do a song like I'm the Walrus. And it makes me wonder how they would have done later on if they had come out, like, say, 20 years later, if they would have had the same success or if labels would have tried to pigeonhole them like they tend to do an artist today. You know, they want a similar sound. They want something they can sell, they can market. So, you know, who knows? When we changed, we wrote songs for the sake of writing songs, and we were influenced by what we were doing. Like during our first two records, we were playing a female gay bar down the street, and that's how we made a living. I was playing like five nights a week there, and all they wanted was R&B. So we were playing all the R&B hits, and you know, that kind of influenced what you write. So all of a sudden here comes How Much I Feel, and then, you know, Later Big Part of Me, You're the Only Woman. You know, those were all probably directly influenced from playing that bar.
Your fifth album, you added a new member of the group, too. Bruce Hornsby joined up for Rhode Island, and that was a different direction, too. And it was more more back, I guess, to the way you guys started out, that more progressive sound.
Yes, that's true. Well, during our tenure at Warner Brothers, we met a man named Bob Laguerre, who was instrumental in bringing us to Warner's. And after we had done two records, we finally met this guy. And he was, like, telling us that the reason he brought us over to Warner's was for us to continue our prog side. And we were never aware of this. And so that gave us license to go back to doing the prog, or having songs influenced by prog and taking instrumental chances and going, you know. So, but by the time we finished the record, he had passed away. So we delivered the record to Warner Brothers, and they were kind of like, what's this? Where's Biggest Part of Me? Where's, you know. It was like, that's what I'm saying, the music business is just fickle. It's all about timing, luck, everything, you know, lining up just right.
Well, you guys continue to play and sound as good as ever. You've got a very busy tour schedule, and you've also, you got some family on board as well. Your wife, Mary, is a big part of the band these last several years.
Right. Yes, thank you. And she is, I think, one of the stars of the show. She, you know, we actually do a little tribute to Bruce Hornsby, and she does some vocals that I think she's just tearing it up. And it really makes it worthwhile for me. The road is not the easiest place to survive. So with my wife there, I'm much happier.
As we said, you guys have played so many different styles through the years. You have so many interests. It's a very eclectic sound. These days, you're often lumped under the header yacht rock. Do you like that designation?
It's funny. It used to be called the West Coast sound, you know. In Europe, they always refer to it as West Coast music because, you know, us, the Doobie Brothers, Toto, all those kind of bands, you know. Even artists like, say, Robbie Dupree, who were East Coast, kind of had a West Coast sound to them. So I don't really mind yacht rock, because it's brought a whole new audience to the band, and it's kept the music, like our hits, especially, alive. And it allows us to tour in a lot of different settings. It's good. It's been good. I mean, I wouldn't have chosen the term yacht rock, but, you know, I guess that comes from Christopher Cross's sailing, I guess. I don't. But, you know, come on. It's a door that opened up, and we were able to walk through it, you know?
Well, yeah, and you get new fans and new generations of fans every year. And I love the singles, but I hope, as somebody who's loved the band since the beginning, I hope they go back and listen to some of the great album tracks as well, because there's so much great music there that didn't get heard on the radio that should have been.
Well, thanks. You know what happens now? I mean, when we first came out with, say, with How Much I Feel, you know, it's like there was FM and AM, and, you know, and they both stood their ground, you know, like, so, you know, we were kind of FM darlings before How Much I Feel.
Right.
You know, and actually there was a time when we went to a few FM stations during the release of, Life Beyond LA, the album, and they were, you know, they were kind of mad at us for having released a single like How Much I Feel. And it was kind of like, you know, here we were thinking, you know, we were doing the best songs that we had at that moment. We were just trying to fulfill them the best we could, you know, and we didn't mean to insult anybody. But nowadays, jump forward to when we play today, all those songs, the prog songs, Nice Nice, works perfectly with How Much I Feel. It's like, it's not like night and day anymore. It all seems to just flow together. And so you kind of really wonder what the hubbub is all about, because it doesn't seem to affect anything now.
Well, I've loved your music for a long, long time. It's a real treat to talk with you this afternoon. Burley Drummond from Ambrosia, we wish you continued success. Enjoy your time out on the road and in that still important exotic dancing career.
Thank you. Well, keep staying safe. Thank you.
There you go. Thanks again, Burley.
My pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Burley Drummond of the band Ambrosia here on Downtown. Our thanks to him. Nick Parisi, author of Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination, and singer, actor, entertainer, John Davidson, again, appearing tonight at Johnson Hall in Gardner. And thanks to you for joining us and making us a part of your Sunday as well. What's up for the rest of your day, Mr. Haskell?
I think it's probably going to be reading, and I've got a big project this summer, so I'm going to get started on that, doing some digitizing of old video. That's my summer plans.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm taking it easy. That's my plan for the rest of the day. Need to rest up because we've got some interesting guests tomorrow. Yeah, we love actors on the show, particularly those character actors who can just disappear into a role and play anything. Two of the best in the business will join us tomorrow on Downtown. Our friend William Sanderson from New Heart and Deadwood. He's got a brand new book out called Yes, I'm That Guy. We'll talk about the book and also the Deadwood movie, which premieres in just over a week as well. And Paul Dooley, a guy who's been getting it done for more than six decades. And he is the quintessential that guy. You see him and you go, oh, yeah, I remember him from that and that. And he's been in a ton of movies and television shows. They'll both join us tomorrow. Plus Emma Wilson from the Top Gun program, Alan Adams from The Main Edge with movie reviews as well. Hope you'll join us tomorrow afternoon at 4 for Downtown, right here on Z62 Retro Radio. You're gonna be